Well, last week, oh, by the way, gentlemen, if you forgot yesterday was Valentine's Day, it's too late. last time we started in Joshua chapter 7, verse 16, and we came in the middle of Joshua dealing with Achan's sin. He had taken items from the ban as they overran Jericho. And the banned items were anything made of gold, silver, bronze, or iron. Those were to go in the Lord's treasury and not to be taken by any of the people. And the rest of it was to be burned. So there really was no opportunity for any personal gain or even collective gain as a nation other than those items that would go in God's treasury. And so they went up to Ai and tried to do battle with Ai, and they did it out of their own wisdom. And when they got up there, while they had enough soldiers, they should have easily overrun Ai, they were routed themselves and lost some men as they ran away. And God made it clear that there's a curse on you because there was sin within the community. And just as they had been warned before they took Jericho, that if anyone took any of these banned items, it would be a curse on the whole nation. And so God gave direction to Joshua on how to root out this sin. They were to use lots, and Joshua would pass by based on tribes, families, man by man, and then household by household to find out where the sin was and who had done it. And it landed on Achan from the tribe of Judah. And Joshua urged him to glorify Yahweh by honest confession, no hiding. And Achan did that. He said, "I've sinned against Yahweh. I saw gold, silver, and a mantle of Shinar, which is like a king's robe. I coveted it, I took it, and I hid it." As far as the silver and gold, he had hidden about 200 shekels of silver, which is about 80 ounces, and about 50 shekels of gold, which was 20 ounces. And of course, this robe as well. And as he took it, he tried to hide it and conceal it. It was under his tent. They sent messengers, found the items. Achan, his family, his possessions, and those banned items were taken to the Valley of Achor near Jericho. That name Achor means Valley of Trouble. They were stoned. All of them and their possessions were burned with fire. They were covered with heaps of stones. And the writer said it stands to this day. So it was definitely a symbol of the sin and the results of the sin. And Yahweh said, "My anger's been averted. You're no longer under the curse." And so we saw how the sin was dealt with. And we looked over in Hosea. In the book of Hosea, it said the Valley of Achor was the door of hope for Israel. In other words, when sin is there, resolution of the sin is the door of hope. Yes, it was sad for Achan and his family. Yes, it was a very direct, somewhat brutal punishment for their sin. But the nation was cleansed. And we went to several New Testament passages showing that our responsibilities for dealing with sin and for each other is to tend for our brothers and sisters in Christ. And really, we're in this as a team and as a unit and as a family and not just all on our own. And then we went on in Joshua chapter 8, and we saw that the sin being removed and the curse lifted, a return to the role of God in providing direction and fighting these battles by his power. He promised similar success for their conquest of Ai that he had provided for them in Jericho. The methods were definitely different. They were directed to set an ambush, with the ambushing group to be between the towns of Ai and Bethel. We looked on the handout as to about where that is. It's an elevation higher than where they were in Jericho, about 3,600 feet higher, 12.5 miles away about. We're not 100% sure of all of the locations of some of that. But as the ambushing group was set in place, the rest of Israel was to charge the city, and then they would retreat. As the people of Ai came out, the soldiers came out to do battle with them, and the retreat would look like their defeat from times before, but with the ambushing party there, then the ambushers could take the city. And Joshua says, take the city, and this starts to become key as you think about it. Last time they went up out of their own wisdom, with their own power, looking at their number of soldiers for their strength, and were defeated. This time Joshua says, when you ambushers go into the city, Yahweh will give it to you. They are not voicing their belief and their trust in Yahweh to give them the city. The instructions are, burn the city. There will be 50,000 people waiting in ambush. Joshua and his group were camped to the north. The ambushing team was north, was more on the west. And when the men of Ai see them in pursue, then Joshua and the people will retreat. And Ai then, when the retreat is occurring, calls to the rest of the people in the city, let's all go. And so all of Bethel goes out to chase these people and leaves the city unoccupied. And interestingly enough, the town of Bethel is nearby, and the people from Bethel take out after them as well. So both cities are left unguarded. And that's where we stopped. And so now let's go to Joshua chapter 8, and I'm going to read verses 18 through 29. Joshua 8, 18 through 29. Then the Lord said to Joshua, stretch out the javelin that is in your hand toward Ai, for I will give it into your hand. So Joshua stretched out the javelin that was in his hand toward the city. The men in ambush rose quickly from their place, and when he had stretched out his hand, they ran and entered the city and captured it, and they quickly set the city on fire. When the men of Ai turned back and looked, behold, the smoke of the city ascended to the sky, and they had no place to flee this way or that. For the people who had been fleeing to the wilderness turned against the pursuers. Then when Joshua and all Israel saw that the men in ambush had captured the city and that the smoke of the city ascended, they turned back and slew the men of Ai. The others came out from the city to encounter them, so that they were trapped in the midst of Israel, some on this side and some on that side, and they slew them until no one was left of those who survived or escaped. But they took alive the king of Ai and brought him to Joshua. Now, when Israel had finished killing all the inhabitants of Ai in the field and in the wilderness where they pursued them, and all of them were fallen by the edge of the sword until they were destroyed, then all Israel returned to Ai and struck it with the edge of the sword. All who fell that day, both men and women, were 12,000, all the people of Ai. And for Joshua did not withdraw his hand, which he had stretched out of the javelin, until he had utterly destroyed all the inhabitants of Ai. Israel took only the cattle and the spoil of the city as plunder for themselves, according to the word of the Lord, which he had commanded Joshua. So Joshua burned Ai and made it a heap forever, a desolation until this day. He hanged the king of Ai on a tree until evening, and at sunset Joshua gave the command, and they took his body down from the tree and threw it at the entrance of the city gate and raised over it a great heap of stones that stands to this day. So Yahweh's giving instructions. Yahweh is actually in command of the battle as he should have been all along. And he tells Joshua, stretch out the javelin that's in your hand toward Ai. I'm going to give it to your hand. What's the significance of this directive? Well, I kind of already said it. God had said, I'll give it to your hand. This is now we see Joshua and the Israelites being obedient to the word of God, trusting in his directions in the battle, and not trying to just take it and manage it out of their own strength. Obviously, when the sin was present in the city, they didn't have the strength and they were under a curse. But even now, they're not taking the city by their own strength. They're following the direction of God in doing this. And the men and the ambushers rose up at this signal, and they did capture the city. They did set it ablaze. And as the men of Ai look back, this tower of smoke is rising. And so they come out and they're trapped. And the Israelites turn back from their retreat into the desert land, and they attacked directly against these people that they had been allowing to chase them. And Joshua and the army saw the smoke, and they slew the men of Ai. Others came out of Ai, not warriors at this time, but they were trapped and killed, and there were no escapees. Only the king was kept alive, and he was brought to Joshua. And so when all the outside of the city are dead, they returned to Ai, and any that were left, they put down that day. They killed them until none remained. And all killed that day were 12,000, every one of Ai. And so you would think that the armies of the Lord, the armies of Israel, would have been able to overcome them just on sheer power alone because of the great number of soldiers. I mean, they had 660,000 about from their previous census, and here they were against 12,000 total inhabitants. But this time they were successful because of God's blessing on them. And so Joshua kept his hand stretched out until all were dead. It's reminiscent of Moses in Exodus 17 at Rephidim with the attack by Amalek against the people. And Joshua led that battle. And Aaron and Hur, though, were there because when Moses would lift his hands, they would win. And when he got tired and they would droop, they would lose. And so Aaron and Hur supported Joshua, or supported Moses, to keep his hands up, and they certainly defeated the men of Amalek. And so in the same way, Joshua did not let his javelin signal fall down, stop, come down until the battle was completely over. They did take cattle and spoil for themselves. God had told them they could. It was according to the word of Yahweh, and it also was commanded by Joshua that that would be an acceptable thing for them to do. Joshua and the men burned all of Ai. It became a desolate heap. It was still in that condition when the book was written. And they hanged the king on a tree until evening. I'm sure that you know that it wasn't a hanging like the Kansas Wild West hangings, or even more recent times of capital punishment, that the king would have been killed and then his corpse was hung on a tree, and it hung there on an evening until sunset. Then it was taken down. They threw it in the city entrance, and they raised a great heap over it that was still standing at the time that this book was written. And so they wound up there overtaking two cities, Ai and Bethel, and they were burned. Why do you suppose Yahweh was commanding them that they be burned? Stop and think for a moment about the people of Israel. Where did they come from that day? That day of battle. Where had they been before they went up to Ai and Bethel? Jericho. They were camped at a place that had become named Gilgal. And did they have homes and houses? No, they were basically nomads, we assume. That would have been a kind of a tent dwelling thing. Certainly the tabernacle was a tent type structure. So what do they need? What are they planning on as they continue with the conquest of Israel? What happened east of the Jordan when they took that area? Did they burn all the homes and houses and devastate all the cities?
No, they wanted to stay.
No, this place is all set up for our flocks. And the big shepherding groups of Israel, maybe not all of them, but the ones that stayed were big shepherding groups. They had just what they needed. They had the grazing land, they had the shelters, they had the homes, and so they stayed. So why are we burning these two towns right out of the box? What did Columbus do? Maybe I've got the wrong historical person because I just brought that out of memory. But when ships were brought from Europe to start settling, it might have been Cortez that did it. down in the Spanish areas, what became Spanish areas in the U.S.? What did they do when they got here?
Burn the ships.
Why?
So they couldn't go back.
You're not going home. Get over it. We're here, and we're here to stay. And so it removes some tempting things to do. Like, I don't like this. Let's get on the ships and go home. Well, that wasn't a possibility. And I don't pretend to have the mind of God on this, but it seems to me very likely that God is essentially saying to them, we're not going to just start living in the first two cities we take, or three. That's counterproductive. We've got a whole nation. Now, it's not a very big space, about the size of New Jersey, plus or minus a bit. But we've got a whole area here in towns to take and to take possession of. They're exercising the judgment of God on the Canaanites and the people that lived there. And so God is essentially putting them in a position, we're not done. These are not going to be your new homes. We've got a lot more battling to do before we're done. And so I think that's very likely a part of God's reasoning for doing that. There's also the other side of it, that as they're doing this, they're also bringing God's judgment on these people. And no doubt that was a part of the judgment as well, was that their areas were going to be destroyed, not to be rebuilt in these cases. Questions, comments, thoughts on up through verse 29? Yeah, and I didn't think about that, but that's another thing. Other people from other towns aren't going to be coming here and inhabiting these cities to be strategically at your rear guard. So, yes, good point. Any other comments up through verse 29? Well, in that case, let's read 30 through 35, and we'll finish chapter 8. Then Joshua built an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, in Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the sons of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of uncut stones on which no man had wielded an iron tool. And they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings. He wrote there on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written in the presence of the sons of Israel. All Israel, with their elders and officers and their judges, were standing on both sides of the ark before the Levitical priests, who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord, the stranger as well as the native. Half of them stood in front of Mount Gerizim and half of them in front of Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had given command at first to bless the people of Israel. Then afterward he read all the words of the law, the blessing and the curse, according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded which Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel, with the women and the little ones and the strangers who were living among them. So Joshua goes to Mount Ebal at the end of the war and he builds an altar. It says, in accordance with the commands of Moses. And Moses was the one who served Yahweh, and the commands were to the sons of Israel. They were written in the book, the law of Moses, an altar of uncut stones, no iron tools used by men to prepare the stones. And there they offered burnt offerings. Burnt offerings were of surrender to God, of dedication, of atonement, of allegiance to God, and peace offerings, which were celebrations of fellowship, celebrations of covenant and harmony between the people and with God. And they wrote on stones a copy of the law of Moses as he had written in front of Israel. And Israel and all the elders, the officers and the judges that were on both sides of the ark before the Levitical priests that had carried the ark of the Lord. And this included the strangers. Half were in front of Mount Gerizim and the other were in half, were in front of Mount Ebal, just as Moses had commanded. All right, let's stretch your memories. Where did we read about Moses commanding all of that? Okay, we'll turn back to that in a minute and remind you. Now, while they're there, Joshua read all the words of the law, both the blessings and the curses, according to the book of the law. And not a word Moses had commanded that Joshua did not read before the people, the assembled congregation of Israel, including men, women, children, and the strangers among them. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 27. Deuteronomy 27. And we're not going to read the whole chapter, but I think as I remind you of the layout of this chapter, those of you that were in the class when we were covering this will quickly remember what we were talking about. And I say of this chapter, it's more than a chapter long. But if we look at verses 1 through 15, and I'm going to read 1 through 3 to begin with. I'm going to read 1 through 15. I'll just read it and we'll be done with that part of it, or we'll have done that part. Moses said to the elders of Israel, charging the people, saying, keep all the commandments which I commanded you today. So it shall be on the day when you cross the Jordan to the land which the Lord your God gives you, that you shall set up for yourselves large stones and coat them with lime and write on them all the words of this law when you cross over, so that you may enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, a land flowing with milk and honey, as the Lord the God of your fathers promised you. So it shall be when you cross the Jordan, you shall set up on Mount Ebal these stones as I am commanding you today. And you shall coat them with lime. Moreover, you shall build there an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. You shall not wield an iron tool on them. You shall build the altar of the Lord your God of uncut stones, offering to the Lord your God. And you shall sacrifice peace offerings and eat there and rejoice before the Lord your God. You shall write on the stones all the words of this law very distinctly. Then Moses and the Levitical priest spoke to all Israel, saying, be silent and listen, O Israel. This day you have become a people for the Lord your God. You shall therefore obey the Lord your God and do his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today. Moses also charged the people on that day, saying, when you cross the Jordan, these shall stand on Mount Gerizim to bless the people, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Joseph, and Benjamin. For the curse, these shall stand on Mount Ebal, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali. The Levites shall then answer and say to all the men of Israel with a loud voice, cursed is the man who makes an idol or a molten image, an abomination to the Lord, the work of the hands of the craftsman, and sets it up as a seat in secret. And all the people shall answer and say, amen. And we continue down through this chapter of curses that were to be delivered to the people standing on these two mounts. And if you look at that, that's just exactly what Joshua is doing, right? He saw what Moses had commanded, and here they are. They've crossed the Jordan, and they're at those two places, and they are voicing what Moses had given them to say, to remind them to follow God. The curses are about disobedience to God. And they list all these curses that they're now going to be saying on the mountains. And then in chapter 28, in the first three verses, we see then, now it shall be if you diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. All these blessings will come upon you and overtake you if you obey the Lord your God. Blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the country. And we continue with the series of blessings that Moses gave them to pronounce as they entered the promised land. And so here they are celebrating and remembering and obeying God and Moses' direction in providing the law and providing the book of the law and all those things that are written. And so there is much to be written down here. And go over to chapter 31 for a moment, and we're going to read 24 through 26. Moses wrote these things in what is called a book in our English Bibles, but it's a collection of the law. And in chapter 31, beginning in verse 24, it says this: "It came about when Moses finished writing the words of this law in a book until they were complete, that Moses commanded the Levites who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, saying, 'Take this book of the law and place it beside the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may remain there as a witness against you.'" Here is the book, and Moses has written down everything that God gave him to give to the people as instructions for how to live, and that book is there to be a reminder against them, a reminder to hold them accountable that they will indeed live out what Moses has given them in the law. And so this is a huge event that's occurring here. It's the moment where they're recognizing we're now here, we're a nation, we're accountable to God, we're under God's direction, we're going to follow God, our obedience to God is important, we're pledging that, and we're also showing it by obedience to the directions given by Moses as he was ending his life and his ministry and setting them on the path to be ready to enter the promised land. One more place to turn to. Joshua 1, verse 8. We tend to take this verse and apply it to ourselves, and I think we should absolutely do that. But in the context of what's going on here, it has some very specific meaning for Joshua and the people as well. Joshua is given this instruction after the death of Moses, and what God is directing him to do, and this is one of the directing phrases or sentences. "This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it, for then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success." And we emphasized this a little bit when we went through chapter 8, verse 1. "This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth." And here is Joshua reading the entire book of the law to the people and taking the responsibility to write the entire book of the law on these stones erected as a memorial and a testament to what it means to be the people of God, Israel, in the promised land. And certainly the principle that's here applies to us. As we follow God, then we are going to find prosperity in the kingdom of God, not necessarily is it intended to make us rich financially in this world, but we will have prosperity in the kingdom of God, we will have success in the kingdom of God, and we will be spiritual overcomers and succeed in serving God well. Questions, comments? Well, I made it a little longer today. Okay, well, let's turn over to Joshua chapter 9. And I'm going to start with the first 15 verses. Now, it came about, let me turn to the right place. Okay. Joshua 9, beginning in verse 1. What do you know? Starts with the same exact words. "Now, it came about when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland and in all the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard of it, that they gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and with Israel." When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, they also acted craftily and set out as envoys and took worn-out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins worn out, torn and mended, and worn-out and patched sandals on their feet and worn-out clothes on themselves. And all the bread of their provision was dry and had become crumbled. Then they went to Joshua on the camp, went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the men of Israel, "We've come from a far country. Now therefore make a covenant with us." The men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you are living within our land. How then shall we make a covenant with you?" But they said to Joshua, We are your servants." Then Joshua said to them, "Who are you and where do you come from?" They said to him, "Your servants have come from a very far country because of the fame of the Lord your God, for we have heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and to Og, the king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions in your hand for your journey and go to meet them and say to them, we are your servants. Now then, make a covenant with us. This, our bread, was warm when we took it for our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you. But now behold, it is dry, it's become crumbled. These wineskins which we fitted were new, and behold, they are torn. And these are clothes, and our sandals are worn out because of the very long journey.' So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them." So the first thing we hear is that the kings that are on the west side of the Jordan, the ones in the area that will become their conquest area, heard about the defeat of Ai and Bethel. And what did they decide to do?
Join forces to fight.
Yeah. They'll certainly take us separately. Let's get together. What drove them to this kind of reaction? Simple one-word answer will work.
Fear.
Yeah. They were afraid. They were convinced that they were in peril at the hands of this army that was moving about. And it's worth looking at, because what did they remember? They remembered what had happened. I guess it's the Gibeonites that I'm thinking of. Sorry, we'll get to that in a minute. So they're out there massing together. Now, Gibeon took their own route. The Gibeonites were in a community not far from Ai. As a matter of fact, if you look at the map we handed out a couple weeks ago, you'll see that Gibeon is just southwest of Ai. If it was 15 miles from Jericho to Ai, it was probably 6 miles or something like that as the crow flies down to Gibeon. So they weren't very far away. And they're looking at this situation, and instead of joining with the other kings and so on in the countryside, most of these kings were city kings, they come up with a better plan. What's their plan?
Make peace by deception.
Peace by deception. They are described, the New American Standard translates it, that they had a crafty response. They were crafty. Does that mean they were good woodworkers? No. What does it mean they were crafty?
Cunning.
What's that?
Cunning.
Deceitful.
Deceitful. Those two go together for what they did. You could be cunning without being deceitful. I mean, you could take truths and maybe have some sort of a deal making or a resolution to a problem with somebody, and you might just be wise in what you did, and you could say, that was pretty cunning. You're really thinking. But in this case, it definitely deserves all the negative connotation you can put on it because they were deceitful. How did they manage or put forward their deceit?
Pretend to be ambassadors.
Pretended to be ambassadors. It said they came down as, the New American Standard calls them envoys. Anybody have, somebody said ambassadors, is that how they translated in some of yours? Yeah, that's what they mean. They're representatives of somebody else. We were sent here to represent these people. And who did they say the people were that sent them? What do you learn about those people? In terms of what's recorded here, at least.
They say they're from far off.
Yeah, you don't, they don't say, see, they were a little bit in an awkward spot. Because if they start putting names on themselves, somebody might know that, well, wait a minute. You're not from those people. I know those people. Know what they're like or whatever. You don't fit that. So about the only thing they're kind of silent about where they actually came from. They just said, oh, way out there. Kind of like an old Star Trek show. Where are you from? Oh, we're from a long ways away. Not wanting to say they were from space, which was a, obvious fiction. But here we are, they're being crafty, they're full of guile, they're subtle. And so they set out as an envoy, ambassadors, and they try to make the illusion work. And how do they do that?
Worn out clothes.
Yeah, they showed up with flat tires. Yeah, our tires were out on this trip, that kind of a thing. They're there in worn out clothes, they have worn out sacks on their donkeys, their sacks would have been full of what they needed to travel. They have wineskins that are shot, worn, torn, mended. Their shoes aren't any good. And to me, this one's a little bit, maybe I think of the bread that I eat instead of the bread they had, but to have dry, crumbly bread, it would have been gone. I mean, it wouldn't have lasted as long as it took to wear out shoes and clothes and sacks on the donkeys. But yeah, this bread was warm. This was fresh bread when we left. Look how dry it is now. It's just crumbles going to crumbs. And so they met with Joshua and the leaders at where?
Gilgal.
That's interesting. They have made their base camp at Gilgal, and as they have attacked Jericho, of course that was central to Jericho, but even in their attack of the city up at Ai, they've come back and they've kept this camp at Gilgal. And that's where these people come to, and they meet with Joshua and the leaders. Now, in the New American Standard in verse 5, it says, the leader of Israel said to the Hivites, well, who are the Hivites? Well, Gilgal is a Hivite city, and Hivites were part of the Canaanite people. They're just a kind of a specific part. And so they're just part of the Canaanites. And so here these people are there, and the scriptures correctly say, well, they're Hivites. If the leaders of Israel had known that, they probably would have called their bluff here, but they didn't. But they were suspicious. Well, perhaps you live in our own land. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? The Israelites were already realizing that while the land needed cleansed of the inhabitants and the people God was judging, it's our land. So perhaps you live in our land. So then how could we make a covenant with you? What would keep them from making a covenant with these people if they lived in the land here, which they did? But what would be? Why would that be a barrier to making an agreement with them? Yeah, God said to destroy them all, and with regard to the people in the land, they're not the decision makers, are they? If they really understand what's going on, they're there at God's direction, and so we can't make a covenant with you if you're local, because it's the locals that we're here to be up against. So they said, well, we're your servants, there in verse 8. And Joshua said, well, who are you and where are you from? And they don't give much of an answer. We're from a far country. But we have heard of the fame of Yahweh. They can name the God of Israel. We've heard of the fame of Yahweh, your God. We've heard all that he did in Egypt. And we also have heard of the two Amorite kings that were defeated east of the Jordan. They're covering events that are a more than 40-year span, right? Egypt was 40-plus years ago, and what happened east of the Jordan was within the last year or so, probably. And so we heard of that. So instead of saying, this is actually where we're from, they go, we're from a long ways away, but we heard about you folks, and they started lauding the praises or the recognition of the strength of God and the success these people have had. And so we heard of that. So as a result, in verse 11, our elders, the people of our community, have sent us as an envoy, and the people support that, to contact you and to serve you with a covenant. In other words, we're not here to be equals with you. We're just asking that you let us join your band, so to speak, as servants. And they go on to say, look at our bread. It was warm when we left, but now it's just crumbles. Our wineskins were new, but now they're patched and damaged. Our clothes were worn, and so we had a long journey. So in verse 14, it says the men of Israel took some of their goods, so they received essentially a little bit of payment, but they did not ask Yahweh. And so Joshua then joins in with them. He makes a covenant of peace with them to let them live. And the leaders of the Israelites swore an oath to them, an oath that would have been based on Yahweh. So here they are involving Yahweh himself with it through this oath. Questions, comments so far? Okay. Well, let's keep going and see how this situation works out in the near term, at least. Let's look at verses 16 through 27. In verse 16, it says, and it came about at the end of 3 days, after they had made a covenant with them, that they heard that they were neighbors and that they were living within their land. Then the sons of Israel set out and came to their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon and Chephirah and Beeroth and Kiriath-Jearim. The sons of Israel did not strike them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, by Yahweh, the God of Israel. And the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. But all the leaders said to the whole congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we cannot touch them. This we will do to them, even let them live, so that wrath will not be upon us for the oath which we swore to them. The leader said to them, let them live. So they became hewers of wood and drawers of water for the whole congregation, just as the leaders had spoken to them. Then Joshua called for them and spoke to them, saying, why have you deceived us, saying that we were very far from you when you are living within our land? Now, therefore, you are cursed, and you shall never cease being slaves, both hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. So they answered Joshua and said, because it was certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land before you, therefore we feared greatly for our lives because of you and have done this thing. Now behold, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us. Thus he did to them, and delivered them from the hands of the sons of Israel, and they did not kill them. But Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord to this day in the place which he would choose. So 3 days go by, and somehow Israel hears, oh, these people are neighbors. They're just down the road. And they live here in the land. So the Israelites, they're just down the road, came to their cities. They showed up at Gibeon and Chephirah, Beeroth and Kiriath Jearim, and in that general area. And that's where they were, was not far. I mean, you can see on the map where they think that the Gibeonites lived, and their cities right around that area. And so what you would expect is wrath and anger and attack and attempt to put them out and kill them like they were originally told to do. But there was no attack. The leaders said, we've sworn by Yahweh, and we cannot do that. And the people grumbled, understandably. When leaders make mistakes, people tend to grumble, don't they? And the leader's response is, wait a minute, there's an oath here. We can't touch them. We've got to let them live in verse 20, so no wrath will come as would be expected if we violated the oath. So what's the deal with this oath? If somebody made a contract with you and you found out they had been dishonest in their side of the contract, would you feel bound to the contract? No, I wouldn't. My first thought would be, if you think I'm going to honor that contract, you're crazy. It's not going to happen. You did trick me into signing this, and if you tricked me into it, I'm not obligated by it. We're going to have to do it. We see whatever we can do to get this thing made clear that I'm not going to follow it. Were these leaders worried about keeping their word to the Gibeonites? No. What were they worried about? Keeping their word with God. They had pledged in the eyes of God to not attack these people. And they were not going to attack these people and risk the wrath of God. It's probably in this whole encounter the only time that they were thinking clearly about the role of God in their lives. And they're only doing it after they have thoroughly messed it up. Was there time pressure to make that contract with them, that covenant, the day they showed up? I mean, I think a wise person would probably, even in their own wisdom, let alone wisdom from above, have said, oh, hold on here. We don't know anything about you. We're not going to enter in a contract based on your comments that you're from far away. Yes, they had all the trappings, but they could have waited. And so here they are. They're in this contract, and the people don't want to honor it, but the leaders say, no, it's got to be honored because we committed ourselves in the eyes of God to being at peace with them and letting them live. And we're going to let them live so that the wrath of God will not come upon us in verse 20. And so in verse 21, these people became woodcutters and water fetchers for all of Israel. In verse 22, Joshua challenges them, why have you deceived us? And you claimed you were from a land far away, but you live here. Why did you do this? And in verse 23, he says, as a result, therefore, you are now cursed. You will never be anything but slaves among us. And your slavery duties will be woodcutters and fetching water for the house of Yahweh. And they had an answer for that, and it was a pretty good answer in one sense. They said, well, we were told that Yahweh your God commanded Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants, so we were greatly afraid of death at your hand. So we did it. In one sense, you could say they were saying we didn't have anything to lose. We were going to die anyway, so we did the thing we could think of to do to try to save our physical lives. But the other thing is, they were proclaiming that because they had heard Moses said that, Moses had notoriety in the land, didn't he? He had a reputation that was good. And that Yahweh, they're looking at the God of the Israelites, really the God of the universe, but Yahweh had said, you were to kill everybody as a part of what Moses decreed and declared. And so God, through Moses, had said we had to die. We didn't want to die, so we made this attempt. And in verse 25, so we're in your hands. Do what is good and right in your own eyes. In other words, the jig's up. You're going to have to decide how you're going to treat us. And verse 26, they were not killed. They became wood and water slaves, and they were to the time of the writing of this book. And their slavery included tending to those matters for the tabernacle, for the house of God. So what's missing in this whole encounter that should have been there from the Israelites' perspective? What's that?
Asking God for permission.
Well, or direction, yeah. Permission, direction. There was not one time it's mentioned that there was any kind of request of Yahweh. What should we do here? That was very unfortunate for them, and this will play out later in multiple ways. But there's some passages that we ought to look at. Let's first of all go to Psalm 32:8. We're going to push the time just a little bit to do what needs done here, but we're going to get it done regardless of pushing the time a little bit. Psalm 32:8. Some of you have done memorize the word. If you haven't, it's time you did. And this is one of the verses out of there. But it is a very meaningful verse. And there, it's not many words, but the words are packed. Now, this is a time where David was rejoicing over his forgiveness. And he attributes this to God. He's saying that God said, I will instruct you and teach you in the way in which you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. Does that mean that he knew what David looked like? No, that eye upon you verse in there is very meaningful. God essentially saying, I know where you're at. I know where you're doing. I know what your problems are. I know what you need. And I know the direction you need to go. And, you know, he goes on to say, before that, he said, you're my hiding place. And so as David is giving these verses, this information out, we need to recognize that God does that for us when we take our issues to him. Look at Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. By the way, another one from Memorize the Word. Says this about wisdom. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. In all of your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Through Solomon's words here about wisdom, he's saying if you trust in the Lord, he's going to lead you through life in a way that takes you where you need to go and do the things that need to be done. Another one is Numbers 9, 6 through 10. This one they could have been thinking about. It was an example that Moses gave them about dealing with questions he didn't know the answer to on his own. Numbers 9, 6 through 10. And the situation is they're re-establishing or reinforcing the establishment of their Passover, giving laws about celebrating it. And it was something that people wanted to be a part of, but there were some men who were in a spot and said, hey, we don't want to be left out of this. And so we're going to start with verse 6. But there are some men who were unclean because of the dead person, so that they could not observe the Passover on that day, so they came before Moses and Aaron on that day. These men said to him, though we are unclean because of the dead person, why are we restrained from presenting the offering of the Lord at its appointed time among the sons of Israel? Moses therefore said to them, wait, and I will listen to what the Lord will command concerning you. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, and God gives Moses instruction about how people can celebrate the Passover at an alternative time if they can't do it at the planned time due to being unclean, ceremonially unclean. And that's a great example. And the men and leaders of Israel in our Joshua study, when these Gibeonites came, could have looked back to this kind of an example, because they themselves said, well, how do we know you're really who you say you are? How do we know you don't really live among us? They knew there was uncertainty. And yet, what did they do? They handled it themselves. They thought they knew what wisdom was. They didn't see that even in this situation, they needed to be consulting with Yahweh. And this is very convicting to me. There is so much of life that goes by. When it comes to me, I go, I know what to do here, and I implement what I think is the right thing to do. And you know, most of the time, I think it worked out pretty well. But every once in a while, you go, oh, there was more to this story, and I didn't really know the right answer. And so it's not the times, it's not only the times when we feel confused or uncertain, or recognize that the situation has very high stakes for us in it, that we need to be praying to God. Maybe we even ought to be praying more when we're very confident. Self-confidence is generally not lauded in the scriptures. Pride comes before a fall. And self-confidence is a very close cousin to pride. And so I would just hold out to you and to me, I'll bet you we don't pray near enough. And we don't need to be making covenants with Gibeonites because it has bad results. Questions, comments, thoughts? Yep.
It also does in Psalm 25:20. That's more clearly delineated in Ecclesiastes 5.
Yeah. I've made a few agreements in life that I kept until I found a way to resolve a situation that I vowed after that never, ever, ever again would I make an agreement of that nature. If somebody comes, I'm just going to tell you one real quick, not an actual event, but a category. If somebody comes to you and says, I need to tell you something, but you've got to promise me you'll never tell anybody else, run. I paid a big price emotionally for a few months making an agreement like that and then keeping it until we could get some things resolved so things that needed to be out in the world were out in the world in the way they should have been. So watch out for those agreements. Thank you. See you next time. And I encourage you to read the Ecclesiastes passage. That's good.